It is Friday, October the 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, fate of missing Saudi journalist straining U.S.-Saudi relations.
Neither the United States nor the Saudis want that to happen. It certainly is a very serious problem for the Trump administration.
Negotiating with North Korea.
The Trump administration seems to prefer to do this bilaterally and then form the others afterwards. It, frankly, remains to be seen whether this is really going to work.
Also ahead, the International Day of the Girl, plus some new stars on the music scene. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump has expressed his concern over the fate of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who has been missing since entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October the 2nd.
We're demanding everything. We want to see what's going on here. That's a bad situation. And frankly, the fact that it's a reporter, you could say in many respects it brings it to a level. It's a very serious situation for us and for this White House. We do not like seeing what's going on.
Turkey suspects that Khashoggi was murdered. Saudi Arabia has called that claim baseless. The Washington Post newspaper, citing intelligence sources, says Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered an operation targeting Khashoggi, who had been critical of Saudi policies. A U.S. State Department spokesman said the U.S. had no advance knowledge of any threat against Khashoggi, who fled his native land a year ago and resided here in the U.S. Michael Fishbach, a scholar at Randolph-Macon College, tells my colleague Victor Beatty, all of this will add strain to a complicated relationship among Turkey, Sunni Arab states, and the U.S. as they try to maintain a common alliance against Iran.
In many ways, obviously, the United States and Saudi Arabia are allies. Turkey and Saudi Arabia, there's tremendous Saudi investment in Turkey. They both are positioning themselves as Arab leaders of the Sunni Arab Middle East, to some degree along with Egypt. But yet their mutual ties, that is, between the Saudis and the Turks, have been strained over Saudi Arabia's relentless criticisms and attacks on the Gulf state of Qatar. The Turks actually sent troops to Qatar to prevent any kind of Saudi invasion. So I think the big picture is that as the United States in particular, and as well Saudi Arabia, are trying to coordinate an international bulwark against Iran, that this spat, a very serious spat that's resulting from this disappearance, notably between Saudi Arabia and Turkey, but also now dragging in the United States, could put serious pressures on that alliance against Iran.
Could this interrupt U.S.-Saudi relations?
Well, neither the United States nor the Saudis want that to happen. It certainly is a very serious problem for the Trump administration. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has particularly close ties with the Saudi crown prince, who many speculate is behind this, whatever the this is, if it's a disappearance, if it's a murder. Trump's first visit abroad as president was to Saudi Arabia, and his own Trump companies had a lot of business in Saudi Arabia. So for both personal and diplomatic reasons, not to mention things like oil, joint U.S.-Saudi efforts to contain Iran, neither the United States nor the Saudis want this to explode into a major brouhaha.
What could Saudi Arabia possibly have gained by either Mr. Khashoggi's disappearance, his kidnapping, abduction, or murder?
He was not merely a critic, but a critic from a well-placed family in Saudi Arabia, someone who formerly was fairly cozy with the ruling elites. I mean, in some ways, he's like a defector. In a sense, a defector from the leadership ranks, an insider, if you will, spilling the beans. We also need to consider that, according to press reports, the crown prince is notoriously thin-skinned and averse to criticism. And I think, finally, the fact that Khashoggi, unlike other Arab journalists, is very well known in the West and notably hobnobs with some very important people in Washington, well-known journalists, foreign policy analysts. He's not just some lonely blogger somewhere criticizing the Saudi government. He's well-placed, and I think for all of those reasons, there was a particular desire of the Saudis to see him silenced.
Randolph-Macon College scholar Michael Fishbach speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And later in the program, child rights in Saudi Arabia. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Democrats are energized to vote in the upcoming midterm elections, hoping to defeat or diminish the Republican congressional majority. We talk with Democratic strategist Will Marshall, president of the Progressive Policy Institute, about the obstacles and incentives for Democrats in November. That's Press Conference USA, Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. The relationship between the United States and North Korea has been evolving since Donald Trump became U.S. president. He met with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore in June and intends to hold a similar meeting in the future. Christopher Hill is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea. VOA's Steve Miller in Seoul asked Ambassador Hill about his perception of the current landscape in Asia regarding North Korea.
Well, it's changed a lot over the years. And I think, first of all, with respect to North Korea, the whole six-party process seems to have broken down. And the Trump administration seems to prefer to do this bilaterally and then inform the others afterwards. It remains to be seen whether this is really going to work. Secondly, we have a new government in South Korea, and that government in South Korea seems very anxious to move ahead on so-called peninsula issues, on trying to normalize relations on the peninsula. And the issue is, can that go forward, and it's been going forward pretty rapidly, in the absence of progress on denuclearization? So there's some tension in how that will sort itself out. And then another issue, of course, is China. The U.S. has really kind of thrown the book at China over some longstanding trade and intellectual property rights issues. And I would say the U.S.-China relationship is going through some rough patches right now, meaning that it's need to kind of coordinate with China on North Korea. So a lot of headwinds, if you will, and we'll see how we come out of this.
Now, you brought up the six-party talks, which you were involved with. While back, Kim Jong-un called the process broken, not going anywhere. They've been stalled for a long time. Some people have said, including Moon Jae-in, has said that this leader-to-leader approach is something new and why things are moving forward. But at the same time, you get these agreements like the Singapore summit where it's language that looks nice on paper, but it's short on details, and then you have to wait later for working-level meetings to actually hash things out. I mean, giving the stalled process that we've seen in the past almost decade now, what's your take on at least trying something new?
Look, always good to try new things. But I think I have a little trouble with the notion that somehow these leader-to-leader talks are really working, because I don't see any real movement in the North Korean position with respect to denuclearization. They've said they agree with it, but it sounds like an agreement in theory that is something that over the course of time they might or might not do. But I'm not seeing any specific real follow-up on these things. I think part of the problem, at least with respect to the U.S. participation in leader-to-leader talks, especially with North Korea, I think part of the problem is the U.S. is just so ill-prepared as it goes into these meetings, and now we're going to have a second summit coming up. And there doesn't seem to be a real effort to make clear, you know, what we are trying to achieve in these summits. And I think the real disadvantage of Singapore was, you know, a lot of buildup to this event, and then a piece of paper that came out of it, which was far weaker than papers we've had in the past. So it's not at all clear that things are moving.
In terms of moving, you bring up an interesting thing because, you know, if you look at the language coming out of North Korea and South Korea with their joint declarations, it's a lot of rehashing of what was previously said.
Yes.
If you look at the language coming out of the United States, sometimes it's very conflicting because on one side you have the president saying, hey, we want to make a deal, denuclearization is going to happen, but at the same time it's the old United States line. Sanctions will remain in place until full denuclearization. So with those conflicting messages, what kind of challenges does that present?
I think it presents a lot of challenges. I mean, the U.S. has made very clear that the U.S. supports a process that would lead to denuclearization. But at the same time, the president's saying that we're not going to give any sanctions relief until North Korea does everything. Well, I'll leave it to others to determine the practicality of that, but certainly I don't think North Korea is going to take measures to denuclearize in the absence of measures coming from the U.S.
That's Christopher Hill. He is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea. He was speaking in Seoul with VOA correspondent Steve Miller. In other news, the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child has condemned Saudi Arabia's involvement in Yemen's ongoing civil war, which has killed and injured many children and been responsible for conditions leading to a large-scale amount of hunger and malnutrition. Saudi Arabia is one of six countries the experts looked at in regard to the implementation of the so-called Conventions on the Right of the Child. Lisa Schlein reports now from Geneva on the committee's concluding observations.
Given the ongoing conflict in Yemen, the 18-member Committee on the Rights of the Child agrees it was always going to be difficult to have a discussion with Saudi Arabia about the kingdom's involvement in the war. The United Nations calls the war in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. The UN reports around 1,300 children have been killed and an equal number injured by Saudi-led coalition airstrikes in Yemen since war started in March 2015. The conflict in Yemen pits Iran-backed Houthi rebels against a Saudi-led coalition, which backs the country's internationally recognized government. Committee Vice Chair Clarence Nelson says the Saudi delegation made one concession during the dialogue. He says it acknowledged coalition airstrikes were responsible for what it called accidental casualties among children. He tells VOA the committee questioned the credibility of the team Saudi Arabia set up to investigate these so-called accidents.
Now, the problem, and this is what we pointed out to them with this team, is firstly, it's set up by the coalition. They're essentially investigating themselves. Secondly, it's comprised of members from coalition countries. So it doesn't involve any non-coalition countries. And thirdly, the information that we have is that it is not investigating all, quote, accidents, unquote.
Nelson notes civilians account for about 20% of all casualties in Yemen, many of them children. He says the committee suggested Saudi Arabia take steps to restore the independence of the team, possibly by creating a more credible international body. He adds no one has been held publicly accountable or prosecuted for any crimes. He also says the Saudi delegation told the committee it would consider its observations and concluding recommendations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Former U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama celebrated International Day of the Girl by officially announcing her new Global Girls Alliance. The program, which is part of the Obama Foundation, will seek to empower adolescent girls around the world through education. Mrs. Obama exclusively revealed details of the program on the NBC television program Today. During the appearance, she was asked to comment on and former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's recent edit of her famous quote, which was, "When they go low, we go high." Well, Holder said it should be, "When they go low, we kick them."
Hope wins out. And if you think about how you want your kids to be raised, how you want them to think about life and their opportunities. Do you want them afraid of their neighbors? Do you want them angry? Do you want them vengeful? You know, if we think of the values that we try to promote to our children, Savannah, you're a mother right now. And at this point, you have to think about what are the things you're telling your girls? Which motto do you want them to live by?
Mrs. Obama also spoke about the messages adults send to children.
Party doesn't separate us, color, gender, those kind of things don't separate us. You know, it's the messages that we send. And if we're the adults and the leaders in the room and we're not showing that level of decency, we cannot expect our children to do the same. So that's what I think about when I think about the gestures and the symbols and what our words mean and the impact that it has. I think about the next generation every single time.
That special event also featured performances by Jennifer Hudson, Kelly Clarkson, and Meghan Trainor. Tap dance gets its name from the syncopated sounds made by those special shoes that are decked out with metal taps. While the high-stepping, uniquely American art form got its start during the 1800s as a melting pot of ethnic percussive dances, blending African tribal dances with Scottish hornpipes and jigs. We get more now from Shelley Slender in Albany, California.
Girls skip across the floor at a community center in Albany, California. The clicks and clacks come from metal taps on the heels and toes of their shoes, which give this form of dance its name.
Tap dance is a kind of dance. It's fun because of the tap sound on your shoes.
It makes it a bit louder than ballet. It makes more noise.
While these girls enjoy their classes, tap could be a passing fancy for them.
I think I might be doing tap dance when I'm older. I'm not sure though.
That's not the case for 13-year-old Chance Tom. He started tap lessons here nearly a decade ago. Now he trains overseas at the Royal Academy of Dance, based in London, one of the largest and most prestigious dance organizations in the world. Chance says that whatever career he chooses, he'll find a place for tap.
If I do something like music, then I'll definitely use it to influence a lot of my music. And if I do something like dance, I'll most likely pursue it as a secondary.
These happy hoopers have been pursuing tap for years.
All my worries fade away when I'm in tap class.
85-year-old Joan Youngert calls tap dancing the most wonderful thing in her life.
And I've done all kinds of dance. I've done ballet and modern. I taught modern dance for about 20 years. And I always keep the tap in there because I love it so much. It's good exercise. It keeps your mind really alert because you have to learn new steps, new routines all the time.
Youngert says everyone should learn to dance, and preferably at an early age.
I have a brand new baby in my family now, a grandchild who is 3 months old, and I can't wait to get tap shoes on her.
One day soon, Youngert hopes her granddaughter will be in her first tap class so that this happy, noisy form of dance will continue, alive and kicking. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Albany, California.
And still ahead, the sounds of an up-and-coming singing duo. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The astronomical phenomenon called the fast radio burst, or FRB, is just that, a very quick but powerful blast of radio waves from across the universe. Since FRBs are so quick and pop up randomly from sources all across the sky, astronomers were only able to detect about 25 of them between 2007 and 2016. But new technology offered by the Australia Square Kilometer Array Pathfinder has allowed astronomers to find 20 new FRBs in just 1 year. These recent fast radio burst detections are said to include the closest and brightest fast radio bursts ever detected. While scientists still don't quite know what causes them, they theorize that the amount of energy released by FRBs is quite powerful and could be equivalent to the amount of energy the sun releases over an 80-year period. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
Sleeping in my bed, sleeping in
Lennon and Macy are a Canadian music duo composed of sisters Lennon Ray Louise Stella, born in 1999, and Macy June Marion Stella, born in 2003. They're best known for their roles as Maddie and Daphne Conrad in the musical drama television series Nashville, which aired from 2012 to 2018. Lennon and Macy were born in Ontario and now reside in the U.S. country music capital, Nashville, Tennessee. They are the daughters of singer-songwriter duo Mary Lynn and Brad Stella, who performed together as the Stellas. Ho Hey was a song made famous by the American folk rock band The Lumineers, but Lennon and Macy have gone a long way to making it their own, with a high placing on the Billboard country chart. And on the TV series Nashville, actor and singer Charles Esten portrayed the father of Lennon and Macy's characters. They often sang together, like the song Believing, from season 2 of the series.
I don't remember how I got here with my rose-colored glasses disappeared.
Sometimes my fingers, they can lose touch, start letting go of everything I love.
When I get the feeling that my prayers have hit the ceiling, on those darker days when my faith is lost on me, you keep me believing. My fears are safe here, held in your hands. When I'm broken, you put me back together again.
All that I once was, all I could be, baby, you remind me.
When I get the feeling that my prayers have hit the ceiling, on those darker days when my faith is lost on meaning, you keep me
for you.
When I get the feeling that my prayers have hit the ceiling, on those darker days when my faith is lost on me. When I get the feeling that my prayers have hit the ceiling, on those darker days when
to Nashville airing, Lennon and Macy Stella had their first taste of stardom when their cover of Robin's Call Your Girlfriend went viral on YouTube. The sisters captured millions of hearts worldwide and resulted in their first appearance on the ABC TV show Good Morning America. Now their YouTube channel has more than 100 million views and more than 770,000 subscribers. And in 2017, Macy was tapped to sing the theme to the hit Netflix original series, Spirit Riding Free. And with all of that, Lennon and Macy's careers continue to soar.
I'm setting out into the great unknown. I don't know where I'm
I'm gonna ride, I'm riding free. So come along, let's go along. Come on, this journey with me. I'm gonna ride, I'm riding free. As long as I am here with you, I feel the spirit within me. Yeah.
It really is a great little animated feature. You should check it out on Netflix. It's amazing. A lot on there about girl empowerment and being the father of an 18-month-old daughter, I can tell you, I believe in girl empowerment. That is Lennon and Macy Stella. Check them out on YouTube. They're marvelous. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Up next, the latest world news, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Lennon and Macy Stella.
This is Today in History. On November 12, 1815, American women's rights pioneer Elizabeth Cady Stanton was born. She agitated not just for the right for women to vote, but also for the right to a higher education, a professional career, and a legal identity. On this day in 1866, Sun Yat-sen, often referred to as the father of modern China, was born. Sun became the first provisional president of the Republic of China in 1912, ending centuries of dynastic rule. In 1927, Leon Trotsky was expelled from the Soviet Communist Party, leaving Joseph Stalin in control of the Soviet Union. Trotsky was later deported and exiled to Mexico. In 1929, Academy Award-winning American actress Grace Kelly was born. She would marry Prince Rainier III of Monaco, becoming widely known as Princess Grace in 1956. In 1948, the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, known as the Tokyo War Trials, adjourned after convicting 25 of 28 Japanese civilian and military officials of war crimes committed during the Second World War. In 1954, Ellis Island, the main U.S. immigration control center located in New York Harbor, closed its doors after processing the last of the millions of immigrants that had moved through its doors since 1892. In 1980, Voyager 1, an unmanned American spacecraft, was the first to send back detailed close-up pictures of Saturn, its moons, and rings. In 1991, Indonesian forces opened fire on a crowd of student protesters in Dili, East Timor. More than 250 demonstrators were shot and killed. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
This is VOA News.